Go. We're in business. Okay.
It takes a minute. All right.
Hi. Thank you all for being here. It's actually, I'm real excited. So my job is, I'm just going to try to, in a very straight way, hopefully without telling too many stories and too much editorializing, I'm just going to lay out the arc of the receivership, which and touch on things and move along, hopefully in a way that will trigger questions. So save questions and discussion topics. I'm going to fly through pretty quickly. Whenever I talk about prison medical care and how bad it is, I like to situate it in the context of, how do you say, bad medical care in the United States. The Institute of Medicine said in 1999, we're killing 98,000 people a year just from medical errors in hospitals alone, at the equivalent of a jumbo jet crashing every day. So you would think we could do better than that. In 2001, they came out with a report that essentially took the lessons learned from the organizations in the U.S. who had transformed care somewhat, and they codified it all in a very simple way. So I've been using it as a playbook. I've tried not to be creative at all. I just kind of like do what the IOM says. And the IOM aims are to create patient care that's safe, timely, effective, efficient, equitable, and patient-centered, blah, blah, blah. But in fact, these six strategies are the strategies we're using to transform a system that was really not at all a system completely in shambles into something that makes a little more sense. What I want to do, though, is say a couple of things about sequence. I'll run quickly through the slides of the activities we're doing. Most of the activities we've been engaged in for the last 2 years sort of have yet to hit the ground. It's deep infrastructure, connecting the computers, putting some correctional officers out there so that inmates can actually get to appointments, and working very, very hard with our state agencies, internally and with our state agencies, on things like hiring and firing, that sort of thing. An immense amount of work that really hasn't gotten to the ground yet to support the clinicians in the field. The one thing we have done out of all this is improve the knowledge and skills of the clinicians in the field. We've replaced half of our nursing workforce in the last year. Half of our physicians in the last year, and over a third of our nursing workforce in the last year. So that alone has increased kind of the knowledge in the clinical encounter. Has it made a difference? Yeah, I think so. It's the only thing I can point to that's made, that's potentially had an impact. This is our annualized mortality rate from the first quarter of 2006 to the second quarter of 2008. The line is going in the right direction. It's a remarkable line. I had no expectation that we would decrease mortality by 10% per year in the first 2 years of the receivership. I just didn't expect to. I don't think it's because we're so brilliant. I think it's because, ooh, it was really bad. And again, I will try not to tell stories. This is what happens when you just do the lines year by year to kind of take into account the seasonal mortality bump that you get in winter. I'm going to move pretty quickly through some vision and mission slides just to make some very simple points. The receivership is, our judicial imperative is to get in, get out. We have to do the least amount we can to return care to a constitutional level. So at this point, it looks like another 3 to 5 years, et cetera. But it's all about speed. constitutionally adequate. Bobby, are you going to define constitutionally adequate?
No.
I'm not going to try either. No one knows. The receivership is about medical care, not mental health and not dental. Okay? So we, because we are the receivership and we have access, we have ways to make some things happen, we take the lead on anything that crosses the disciplinary lines. Nursing, medical records, IT, pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera. But we're about, I'm about medical care. The, you know, all of the medical care people work for me, and actually all of the nurses, the psychologists, psychiatrists don't. Where are the inmate patients of the CDCR? The truth is we're moving on having about 8,000 out of state. Those are in the class as well. The point of the receivership is to make things better, hit that constitutional level, and then what the judge wants to hear is that the state can sustain whatever we put into place. So at that point, the receivership ends. The mission, to reduce avoidable morbidity and mortality and protect public health. This is motherhood apple pie. By providing timely access to safe, effective, and efficient medical care. Again, I don't think there's anything terribly controversial there. And integrate with mental health, dental, and disability. At this point, this integration process is taking up about 30% of my time. It's an enormous challenge. We're working, among other things, in the state of California with the Department of Mental Health, which is a different system than the mental health people who are delivering care within the Department of Corrections. So we have the receivership over here, the CDCR, Department of Corrections, mental health and dental people over here, and the Department of Mental Health, which runs acute psych and intermediate care over here. Oh yeah, I love my job. This is roughly what medical care in prison is all about, healthcare in prison. Somebody comes in at reception and supposedly gets primary care. Now, basically, it's in correctional medicine, it's kind of been called sick call. And one of our, Bob Greifinger actually wrote us a note a few months ago and said, I hate the term sick call. Can you kill the word sick call and let it be, you know, a historical term only. So we are actually, I'm a primary care doc, high control kind of person. I was raised in the primary care mode. So it's a huge effort of ours. We're developing transformation of these processes at a speed that I think is unprecedented in American healthcare. We're devoting a lot of resources to it, so it may in fact be possible to move things along in a very accelerated way. Goals, these are kind of rough and a little bit of a grab bag, but these are kind of a turnaround goals. They're not a full-fledged strategic plan. The first one, ensure timely access. We're transforming our screening and assessment processes. Access staffing, we've created, hundreds and hundreds of correctional officer positions. They don't work for us, but we fund them in order to get inmates to where they need to go. We're developing a highfalutin scheduling system and developing a utilization management system pretty much from scratch. The continuum of healthcare services, primary care, chronic care, this is all pretty much straight from the playbook. Emergency medical response, we've been real bad at. We've had any number of deaths because people aren't trained, don't know where the emergency kits are. It's chaos. Correctional officers not being appropriate. Again, I'm going to try not to tell horror stories. Specialty care hospitalization, again, we're just picking up on a UM program that should help make sure that we have appropriate services, not too much, not too low. Recruit, train, retain a professional quality workforce. I've already mentioned that we've recruited a lot of folks with a lot of money. Hopefully, not everybody there is just coin operated. Ideally, we're going to get people who are committed to a public sector mission, who really want to serve this population, and will stick around, through thick and thin. Let's see, quality assurance programs. I'm a quality person. This is kind of what I do. Our peer review has been very active, taking a lot of my time. We're the appeals process, for anybody who's ever been incarcerated. The appeals process is critically important. It was another system that was broken and that we're putting a lot of energy into. We're working as well. I mentioned mental health dental. We're working as well with a federal judge that has an ADA case, Americans with Disabilities Act case, which I consider sort of all my turf. There's no one covered by the ADA that's not sort of my patient. And so we're working very, very closely with the it's called the Armstrong lawsuit to move that along. And I've already mentioned some out-of-state folks, establishing a medical support infrastructure. The pharmacy system was broken. In addition, we actually arrested two of the pharmacists who were just stealing millions of dollars worth of drugs and distributing them from their kitchen. It's beyond belief what's been happening out there.
You weren't
going to
tell stories.
I'm sorry. Stories later. After Bobby, we tell stories. Information systems. I actually said this morning, we did a little talk, that at one point we counted 6,000 desktop computers unconnected to anything except electricity. Thank God they had electricity. That's a big issue for us, electricity. Seriously, in terms of upgrades. They were running 10,000, roughly, 10,000 local access databases. Local access databases can't talk to another access database. This is not the way to run an enterprise, billion-dollar-plus enterprise. So we're, again, deep infrastructure. We're trenching and dropping lines to all the places in the prisons that have computers. And we're spending a fortune, and we've got tons of people out there, and it's going to be December 2009 before we finish. That is, we will not finish work on our medication delivery system until December 2009. And that gives you an idea kind of what, in a 5 to 8 year period, that first 2 years is digging trenches. Should have mentioned telemedicine. Telemedicine, we haven't done any work on yet, but is our great hope for the future. Constructing facilities. We've got San Quentin. How far along? Have you seen San Quentin lately? We have steel in the sky for a new clinic and infirmary at San Quentin. Pretty excited about that. And you may have heard we're building 7 new healthcare facilities that will be healthcare facilities that happen to be secure for 10,000 medical and mental health beds. California prisons are overcrowded to almost 200%, and are located in some remarkable places where it's a little hard for me to recruit healthcare professionals. So we're going to build some healthcare facilities and locate them near urban areas. And every now and then we get a little press about that because it's going to cost a lot of money. All right. This was just from our 9th quarterly report. I should mention we try to be as transparent as possible. So if you want to know anything about what's going on with us, if you look at the website, we put up tons of legal stuff that if you can get through, bless you. Underneath the legal stuff is a fair amount of clinical detail. So our quarterly reports do have pretty fair amount of information. They number thousands of pages if you were to print out all the appendices, et cetera. But if you just read the report itself, it's, 7 or 8 pages. I've forgotten. It's way too long. Just if you want more information, in the last quarterly report, we said basically now we're really underway. I mean, so I've got a lot of projects teed up, and they're going to start to happen in the next few years.
Hi. Well, while this is getting ready, I just want to pay my respect to Nancy and Donna, actually, to my right, who really sort of kick-started my my career in this area. I was initially interested in geriatrics and urban health, and here I am today, not doing that at all, but maybe sort of doing it after all. Hopefully this can be started.
Should we try resume, folks?
Okay, great. That was the right button. Thanks. So I am a UCSF researcher in the Division of Geriatrics, Department of Medicine. I'm also a hospice provider. And I was asked to speak today not really to answer this question, can federal receiverships cure prison non-healthcare, but really to talk about my role as a researcher in this area. So repairing a health system really benefits from multiple stakeholders, providers, patients, families, in the case of a healthcare system outside of prison, policymakers, governing bodies. In this case, all these players are also at play, and also the federal receivership. So what is the role of a researcher in repairing the prison health system? Well, what I see my role is bringing lessons learned from improving other systems and sort of applying them to the prison healthcare system. That said, the research community, at least in the United States, has done a really good job and a profound job at pursuing a longstanding avoidance of prison healthcare. So there's not a lot to work with. So I'm going to tell you about a little piece of research and a little piece of prison, and that's geriatrics in prison. As I said, I'm a geriatrician. Something most of you probably know is that in the United States, 1 in 100 Americans are incarcerated. It's actually a little bit more than that right now. The prison population is growing, and the prison population is dramatically aging. By the year 2030, approximately 30% of U.S. prisoners are expected to be geriatric. In this case, geriatric, unlike sort of the outside world where we define it as roughly 65 and older, prison systems sort of state by state, but around 55 or older is the definition of geriatric in prison. This is because compared to the community, we have increased rates of disease and disability in the prison population. Geriatric prisoners are very expensive. They cost at least $70,000 per year. This is actually data from 1991, but the most recent figure. You can imagine it's probably higher. This is about three times the cost of younger prisoners. And alarmingly, despite this costly age redistribution, little is known about geriatric disability or health care in prison. I'm going to tell you a little bit about geriatric disability. So what it is it's defined as limitations in independence. Can be anything from functional limitations to physical limitations, so activities and physical function, mobility, hearing, memory impairment, frequent falls, even having trouble bathing. And the reason why these and many other geriatric disability markers are extremely important is because they're very strong predictors of high healthcare costs, morbidity, and mortality in older adults. And previous studies by myself and by others, especially in the UK, have found that disability is extremely common among incarcerated older adults. And just a little bit about geriatric disability and the process of informal care. Informal care is really a cornerstone of geriatric health care in this country and in many others. In informal care, laypersons, especially for disabled geriatric persons, report to clinicians about changes in health, changes in symptoms, and often provide informal care. Outside of prison, this might be people like families or friends, neighbors. Inside of prison, studies have shown that other prisoners are usually the caregivers, and sometimes people identify correctional officers or prison guards as caregivers. This isn't so much that they have an official role in care. They have a role in informal care. This is because studies show that officers are often the staff members who have the most sustained daily contact with prisoners, so they may identify changes in function or new symptoms before anyone else does, including the physicians and nurses. They often also function sort of as the gatekeepers of timely access to healthcare, the liaison between the prisoner and the healthcare system. This person needs healthcare, they're not asking for it, I'm going to go ahead and tell the physician myself. But there are many limitations in the officer role as a caregiver. Officers are rarely changed to recognize geriatric disability, for example. Overcrowding, as we just heard, 200% in California, can impede the familiarity with their prisoners that are assigned to them. And there's always a potential conflict of interest because caregiving and control are often at odds. So our goal is to further explore this idea of what is the correctional officer's sort of informal role in prison healthcare. First, we want to assess correctional officers' knowledge and perspectives of the health and disability of their assigned geriatric prisoners. And then we wanted to contrast their reports with Department of Corrections, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR, reports. So about our data sort, this was a quality improvement project that was commissioned by the CDCR under direction of that same federal judge that Dr. Hill was talking about. And it was done to assess the needs of older adults in California state prisons. That said, this project is separate from that. This is an academic project. The data were analyzed totally independently from the CDCR. Our study design, I'm going to run through because I want to get to our results. Basically, we had three sources. We had questionnaires with 71 correctional officers who were assigned to a random sample of 618 geriatric prisoners. Prisoners were 55 years and older. They came from 11 of the 30 California state prisons. We also had data from medical chart review, basically about medical diagnoses. And then we had some demographic data from the Department of Corrections, age, facility, and something called the Armstrong Criteria designation, which I'll talk about in a minute. We also completed 41 additional questionnaires. This was just sort of snowball. We went in and we said, who do you consider high risk? And if they weren't on our random sample, we'll collect information about them anyway. So the first thing we did is we went up to each officer and we said, do you know this prisoner on our random sample? Well, a little or not at all. These were the officers that were assigned to that prisoner. If they said not at all, the interview concluded and the person was classified as not known. If they said very well or a little, the questionnaire was administered and they were classified as known. And then at the end of the interview, we asked, are there other older prisoners we've not asked you about that you consider high risk for adverse events? And if so, we completed questionnaires. So the questionnaire had a lot of questions in it. Some of the highlights were this thing called the CDCR Armstrong Disability Tracking System. Again, this is based on the lawsuit that Dr. Hill was talking about disability in prison. The CDCR at that time, and this was in 2005, tracked disability among all prisoners. And the disability was defined as wheelchair use, mobility impairment, hearing, vision, or speech impairment. Now, remember, I talked about a lot of other disabilities that exist in this population, but these are the things that are tracked by the Department of Corrections. And we got this information from the Department of Corrections about each person, but we also asked the officer. We looked at geriatric syndromes, things like activities of daily living impairment. These are the functional issues in daily life. We looked at frequent falls in the last year, incontinence in the last 2 weeks, memory deficits, so cognitive impairment. And these questions were based on minimum data set questions from nursing home surveys. And then we also looked at a couple non-traditional measures. We asked officers whether or not the geriatric prisoner was safe or unsafe in their current housing unit, and whether they felt that the person would require a higher level of care within the year. Our analyses were primarily descriptive, and I can tell you all about it later if you like. So, our first finding was that many geriatric prisoners were actually completely unknown to their assigned officer. Of the 618 randomly sampled geriatric prisoners, 34% were totally unknown to their assigned officer, and actually about a quarter of prisoners who were 70 years or older were totally unknown to their assigned officer. Of those 211 unknown prisoners, the average age was 90 years. And 12% of those unknown prisoners were noted to be disabled by the Department of Corrections, so they had one of those five designations of Armstrong criteria. So a couple examples. I just wanted to bring some of the some of my subjects into the room with me today. Some of the unknown geriatric prisoners, we had a 93-year-old man who was assigned to a top bunk. We had a 76-year-old woman with dementia and hearing loss identified by the Department of Corrections as having mobility and impairment. And again, these people weren't known to their assigned officer. So here's just a little bit of information about the known prisoners, the 407 who were known. The mean age was 62 years, with a range of 55 to 89 years. About 5% were impaired in ADL, 19% in mobility impairment. And correctional officers, this is all correctional officer reports, reported that about 16% would require a higher level of care within the year. Incidentally, the correctional officers said that about 50% of the prisoners over age 70, the ones that they knew, would require a higher level of care within the year. So examples of some of the prisoners who officers knew, a 65-year-old man with Parkinson's. The officer stated, he's full assistance across the board. He needs to be in a nursing home, not a prison. He's unsafe and he needs more care. In some cases, the officers actually identified ways that the prison environment contributed to disability. For example, there's a 63-year-old man who had no identifiable disability according to any of our markers of disability, but the officer said that he required assistance when he was walking while handcuffed, otherwise he would fall. This slide shows concordance between correctional officers and Department of Correction reports of disability. And basically what each of these sections shows is, for example, up here in the upper left is mobility. We see Department of Corrections in this circle. These are the number of people that they identified with mobility impairment. This is the number that the officers identified with impairment, and this is the number that both identified with impairment. And basically what this information shows us is officers identified more people with impairment, but the overlap was pretty small, so we really can't rely on either system's identification of impairment alone. So some of those discordant reports, when we looked more carefully, involved actually quite significantly disabled prisoners. For example, a 70-year-old man with no Department of Corrections disability designation was identified as high risk by his officer because he had memory impairment and difficult getting from his bed into standing position. He said he forgets his medicines, he loses his way to his cell, he can't recall staff names, he forgets that he's in prison. He gets into fights because he ends up in the wrong cell, he's unsafe, and he needs more care. An 84-year-old man was identified by both the Department of Corrections and the officers having hearing impairment, but actually the officer was concerned about his memory impairment, again, something that the Department of Corrections is not tracking. He thinks he's paroled every week. Every day he packs his bags, and I have to help him unpack at the end of the day. He's an easy target, and I have to watch him closely. I'm going to skip this in the interest of time. Actually, just to say that this slide basically shows that the geriatric prisoners who officers identified as particularly high risk were a very different group, not surprisingly, than our random sample. They basically had much higher rates of all the things that we considered to be highly disabled in the geriatric population. And an example of a high-risk geriatric prisoner was a 73-year-old man who refuses his wheelchair. And his officer states he's been forgetting that he's incontinent of urine, and now he's accusing other prisoners of throwing urine on him. And this man was getting into fights because of that. So, in summary, we found that there's significant need for improvement in geriatric assessment in the prison system. A third of prisoners that were geriatric were completely unknown to their officer, and 12% of those had Department of Corrections designation of disability. Officers identified more prisoners with disability than the Department of Corrections did, but the overlap between the department and the officers was only fair. We found that high-risk prisoners identified by officers as being high-risk had nursing home-level impairments. And the officers were identifying disability like memory impairment, incontinence, and also disabilities that are unique to prison. So the implications of this study are that to improve disability assessment in prison, we have to expand the definition of disability, we need to include more geriatric disability markers, we need to include disability unique to prison, that the correctional officer is a great opportunity to target training about disability assessment, and that the overlap between officers and Department of Corrections is only fair, so we really need to be using both systems to reassess for disability and at regular intervals. And finally, I'm going to answer the question even though I have 15 seconds left. So how can the federal receivership find a cure? And my answer would be, from a researcher's perspective, to encourage external inquiry and evaluation through research, to introduce and assess innovative programs, for example, training officers in how to detect geriatric disability, and to use findings from research to promote evidence-based change. Thanks so much.
I'm going to try to follow that. When I come to conferences and I go to places where laws are being made and I hear legislation and I hear these types of statistics and information, I literally get ill. On my way home, I'll probably be ill. I'll have to go get a massage tomorrow because I'm very familiar and I know these people. I had a son who was accidentally killed in 1982 by a police officer. I drank after that death and used drugs, and therefore I was committed to state prison. And I cycled in and out of prison for the next 15 years. Thank God I did not get sick. You know, I still, in my prayers, have this gratitude for not getting sick while incarcerated. But I did see other women who got sick. And it's, you know, the memory of that is just really difficult. While going through prison, I never was able to access treatment for my substance abuse. But in 1996 was the last time I was released, and in 1997, I received treatment at a place called Clear Foundation. I returned back to my community of South LA, committed to helping women make that transition from prisons and jails in California. And that was 1998 that I went back and began to commit myself to doing this. And over the last 10 years, there's been over 250 women. We went from my own personal home. Now we have 5 homes, and we've just expanded to Oklahoma, a state that incarcerates more women per capita than any other place in the world. But in the last 10 years, the women, the condition, both physical, mental, and emotional, that the women coming out of prison, the condition they are when they come into those homes continues to be horrific. You know, we do advocacy now and leadership training to heal the emotional, spiritual damage, and advocacy to get that person what they need, be it their medication through the parolee outpatient clinic, be it their medicine for arthritis or diabetes or high blood pressure. And a person just can't leave prison and actually access that. They need an ID, they need a Social Security card, they need information to where the clinics are in their community. You know, just a lot of things that we take for granted is some of what is needed. So I don't know. Do I believe the receivership? This is the question I'm thinking about as I hear the information being given. Do I believe the receivership can do what's needed for people to actually have adequate? Was it adequate? Medical care or constitutionally adequate medical care? I don't know. The culture in which this medical care has to be given in is such a culture. I don't know what it takes to transform those California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation officers. You know, and if you're giving medical care in that type of setting, it's just questionable in my mind. I hope all the success in the world, because, you know, one of the things that we, you know, believe to our core that prisoners are people, and they should be treated with dignity and respect. You know, I had a substance abuse problem and an illness, and the largest part of the prison population are people like me. And as long as we're continuing to overcrowd our prisons with ill people that have an illness like substance abuse, we'll the other part of this is, will we be able to actually provide medical care and some type of humane safety and security for those that really can't, really might do some real harm to the that are a risk to the community? I say we need to let some people go. You know, I say that we need to, you know, transfer some of those resources into the community where substance abuse, psychological counseling, mental health, and all of that can be accessed. That's my solution. I want to thank Nancy for asking me, because I'm not a doctor, and this is a really high-end conference, and it's my honor and pleasure to be here, and I'm going to go get a massage tomorrow, and thank you all for being here, too.
Thank you, Susan.
Let me just say, too, and our annual report is back there on the back for anyone who wants to get it.
So I'm coming to this question from a couple different perspectives, one as a former prisoner and somebody who's seen a lot of the suffering that people experience inside, and the other as an advocate for the rights of prisoners, particularly to medical care. And I want to also look at this, I want to try to respond to this question from two different lenses. One is about the mandate of the receivership, and the other is from a broader perspective of public health and social justice. I worked for 5 years at Legal Services for Prisoners with Children on a lawsuit called the Shoemate lawsuit, and that lawsuit and the results of that inform a lot of what I have to say today, as well as interviews with the women that we visit on a regular basis in the California system. And I just want to preface my remarks by saying that I have the utmost respect for people who have rolled up their sleeves and are in the system and are trying to change it, for the medical providers who really have the interests of their patients at heart. And as a former prisoner, I know the difference between how precious it is to have somebody who's a competent and compassionate provider in that setting. They're worth their weight in gold. I also have a lot of reservations about how this receivership, what it might be able to accomplish. We litigated it for 5 years, a lawsuit about the lack of medical care in the women's prisons, and this was a lawsuit that we won on paper and lost in practice on the ground. And I was extremely concerned with the lack of oversight and the lack of monitoring that meant that within a very short period of time of the resolution of that case, the care became as degraded as it was before that lawsuit. And I'm also nervous a little bit about, when I look at the receivership, about the pressure to produce these changes very quickly. This is a very degraded system. This is a system where, as the courts have told us, at least one person a week has died of medical care. I know Dr. Hill has shown that the stats are getting better, but this was a long time in the making, this crisis, and it's going to be a long time in resolving it and bringing in staff who can actually provide the kind of care that the lawsuit is asking for and the receivership is asking for. I'll tell you that in our interviews with the women in the last couple of years, the women that we visited in prison, essentially the same conditions that got us into the Shoemate lawsuit in 1995 exist, I would say with one exception. The women that we've interviewed have said that the biggest change that they've noticed is the presence of more competent and compassionate medical providers. And as one woman I interviewed said, I've been in prison 10 years, and last week was the first time a doctor ever said to me, "Hi, my name is Dr. X. What can I do for you today?" And she was like tearing up when she told me the story. She said she so I give credit to the receivership for setting a higher standard and making this happen. I also feel the from what we've heard, the prescription, the pharmacy issues are really a mess. It's really difficult for people to get their prescriptions on time. It's very difficult for people to get access to their medical records when they're seeing outside specialists. There's a lot of hang-ups in that system. I'll briefly tell one story, which is of a 78-year-old woman that we visit who has multiple health problems, who goes to, she's brought periodically to the outside hospital. I believe she goes to the hospital in Davis. So she's in the Central Valley. It's about a 3 or 3.5 hour trip for her. So she's, I believe, 78 years old now. She's a lifer. So every time she goes, she's been taken 6 times to the outside hospital and has 1 time seen a doctor. So she comes, they wake her up at 4:30 in the morning. She doesn't get breakfast. She's shackled and chained, transported for 3 hours. She gets to UC Davis. And there, the first time they brought her in, they didn't have her medical records, so she couldn't be seen. The second time she came in, she got some tests. The 2 second visits that she had, both appointments had been canceled by UC Davis, but the prison system hadn't heard about it. So here's this poor woman who gets up at 4:30 in the morning, 3 hours there, a long wait, 3 hours back, no breakfast, no lunch. The last time I saw her, she said, I'm going to refuse any more outside visits. I can't, I'm too old for this. I'm not going to do it. So that means that she'll get written up and sent to the hole for refusing care. So that's my one story. So there's just a lot of bureaucratic problems that remain that have not yet been solved and I think will be a long time in resolution. The other area of grave concern to us is the mental health arena and a real spike in suicides in the women's prisons in the last year and a half. And, you know, I know that the receivership is trying to integrate these various systems of health care, but it's my organization's belief that without addressing overcrowding and until California has a different attitude towards crime and punishment, that it will be impossible to provide a constitutionally mandated level of care, of health care in the system that is so bloated and so overcrowded and subject to such mismanagement. It seems, even though it, you know, I do believe that changes can come in the next period of time. I think there's going to be untold human suffering between now and when these things are solved. From a social justice perspective, which is really different from the court-mandated medical care, I am in Susan's camp. I think until we start letting people out, until we have a different attitude towards who we send to prison and why we send to prison, it's, to me, prisons will only be pathogenic institutions. They're only if we look at what is the effect on the health of the individual prisoner, their families, and communities. And we're talking here, folks, about 2/3 of the people locked up in California prisons are people of color. This is having enormous impact on communities that already suffer from lack of resources, poor health. So it's only compounding the problem. So I really don't think until we reprioritize what's important in this society and where we put our money, that until we do that, it's really very difficult for me to say from a public health standpoint and a social justice standpoint that the receivership can really get to the root of the crisis. And I'm not trying, again, I don't want to minimize the real changes that have happened so far and that are being I don't want to minimize the vision of the receivership, but I also think that the problems or the solutions are going to come, like many things in public health, the solutions will come from social policies and not so much from a narrow medical perspective. I mean, we're looking at prisons that have become the largest mental health facilities in this country. They are the largest battered women shelters in this country. They are the largest public housing providers in this country. And I think we can do better than this. I'm not resigned to that this is the best we can do. I actually missed Michael Marmot's opening speech, but I heard that it was very inspiring, and I think we need to reorient ourselves or this questioning in that framework of how do we create the conditions in which people can be healthy. One of my public health heroes is Rudolf Virchow, and I think about in 1848 when he was asked to go to Silesia and analyze what were the causes of the typhoid epidemic, and he came back from that. He did it, his report to the government was not, we need more doctors and we need more hospitals. He said, we need full employment, we need agricultural cooperatives, we need universal education. This is what will prevent another epidemic like this typhus epidemic. And I think, you know, the parallels for us today are, if we want to look at what are the conditions that will create healthy communities in California, vis-a-vis, you know, when we put it up against the prison system, when we have policies that only use prisons as a last resort, where we put everything into prevention and early intervention, that when we change our mandatory minimum policies, when we stop criminalizing and punishing people who have an illness of substance abuse, when these changes start to happen, then I think we will lay the basis for being able to really provide medical care to the few people who may have to be locked up in our prisons. But I don't think brick and mortar will solve it. I don't think 10,000 beds for medically ill and mentally ill, really fragile people, people who should not be in these situations in the first place, I don't think that will solve it. So anyway, thank you for your time, and we're ready for Dr. Cohen. Okay.